No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Our guest tonight is a very special guest. He's not going to be able to stay the whole show because he's got important work to do. So we're not going to take calls tonight. Tonight we're going to just talk to the Reverend Mark Thompson, who has spent half his life as a political activist in Washington, D.C., before he relocated to New York City. His civil rights political organizing includes the 1984 and 1988 Jesse Jackson presidential campaigns, the movement forcing Georgetown University to divest from apartheid South Africa, weekly civil disobedience on Capitol Hill, where he was jailed for 20 days and helped win the first ever congressional vote on D.C. statehood, which is one of the many reasons we love him, the Million Man March. And Mark has emceed every anniversary march on Washington. He also worked on the 2004 Sharpton presidential campaign, the Women's March, the opening of the Martin Luther King Memorial, and many Democratic conventions. Mark, welcome to the show, and we're so pleased to have you.
God bless you, Senator. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you, and you opened with one of my favorite songs.
Oh, is that right? Me too. I love Sweet Honey in the Rock. And you know what? I got to tell you, after reading your bio, I'm just shocked that you and I haven't been, you know, crossed paths more, as I was a direct mail consultant on the 1988 Jesse Jackson presidential campaign when I had my consulting firm. I've had some job at the past 10 consecutive Democratic National Conventions, and I was an ambassador when they opened the Martin Luther King Memorial, one of the great honors that I had, and what it was just such a wonderful experience. You know, I stood at the when people came into the memorial and greeted them in kind of the pre-opening. We were kind of the Walmart greeters of the memorial.
Yeah.
You know, we said hello to people and stuff, and it was just so moving. I got to tell you, before I ask my first question, this quick story that I saw two people who stood in front of the memorial for a few seconds and then realized that they knew each other. They had been arrested together at a lunch counter sit-in and hadn't seen each other since. And they embraced and stood. Yeah, it was such a moving moment. I will never, ever forget it. So let's talk about what you're planning to do on the 28th of this month. Our listeners might not realize that is the 58th anniversary of the March on Washington, which was organized by A. Philip Randolph and is best known for Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. So what's the plan? You've titled the march "Make Good Trouble," which, of course, Congressman John Lewis used to say all the time. One of my mentors, and maybe one of yours too. So let's talk about that. How are we going to make good trouble?
Well, again, thanks for having me on the show. We are going to gather at the sacred location of the Lincoln Memorial once again on August 28th. It will be the 58th anniversary, but we're not coming necessarily just for a commemoration. We're coming to continue action. I think that's what A. Philip Randolph would want. I think that's what Dorothy Height would want. I think that's what Dr. King would want. I think that's what John Lewis would definitely want. Because we're sliding backwards, Senator. Congress, or shall I say the U.S. Senate itself, the body that you are a member of, you are an elected member of a body that still won't recognize you. And that is the point why we are gathering. In addition to the voter suppression that is going on across the country and in dozens of states, the For the People Act would prevent that voter suppression. The U.S. Senate is not moving on that. Justice and policing, the U.S. Senate is not moving on that. There are so many issues that are of urgency to all of our communities that we need this log-jammed Senate to move on. That includes even the filibuster. That includes immigration reform. That includes climate change. You know, when we gather at the Lincoln Memorial, it's hard to be centered on one issue, because Dr. King himself was about diversity. By the time of his untimely assassination in 1968, he was building a beloved community, and it addressed so many issues: wages, jobs, unemployment. All of those things were addressed within the context of the beloved community. So that is what we are seeking to do again. But of course, we could not come to Washington, D.C. I could not come to the city of my birth, the city where I spent more than half of my life, without raising the issue once again of taxation without representation. As a matter of fact, all of these issues I just named could be resolved with D.C. statehood. D.C. statehood is almost the panacea at this moment. Now, it hasn't always been the panacea of everything, but it is now, and we know why. Those two votes in the Senate that would occur, that would materialize if D.C. were granted statehood, would be the votes necessary to get a lot of other things done in the Senate, would be the votes to end, in fact, the filibuster. So that is the urgency of the moment. We're inviting everyone to join us at 9 a.m. at the Lincoln Memorial. We're going to make some good trouble. We're going to make some noise. We're going to hear from some speakers. We're going to hear some entertainment. We're going to hear from you, Senator Michael Brown. We're going to hear from a lot of people in Washington, D.C., but also people around the country with diverse backgrounds and diverse experiences to talk about all of these issues that we face and what we're going to do about them. We cannot stop. In 1963, there were countless demonstrations, daily civil disobedience that led up to August 28th. It's happening again in 2021. It's going to happen beyond 2021. This is a summer of high action, a summer of high mass action, and we want everyone to join in.
Well, I can't agree with you more, Reverend. You know, one of my favorite quotes from the Bible is Ecclesiastes, that to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. And it just feels to me like our time is coming, you know, that I feel this pent-up frustration on the part of America, and, you know, with all the unfortunate things that we've been through lately, the pandemic, the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and, you know, all this, I feel that there's a really pent-up frustration, and I hope it comes to fruition in front of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28th, and that we do make good trouble. Let me ask you about a few things. One of the things that you want to talk about is reparations, and I'm proud to say that we had William Darity, who's one of the experts on the subject from Duke University, on our show. And I know that Sheila Jackson Lee, another one of my favorite members of Congress from Texas, has a bill in to study how reparations would take place. And it has 193 co-sponsors, and it's been reported out by the Judiciary Committee. So what do you see, if you got to sit on that commission, how do you see reparations working?
Well, whoever is on the commission, I doubt it would be me. Reparations is plural. It's not reparation, it's reparations. Uh-huh. And I think we need to understand that, you know, with all due respect to Dr. Darity, you know, he and I disagree with that. He sees it as one solution for one group of people. But what this commission would do would be to pull together individuals to reach out into the community to ask and answer the very question that you just raised. You know, what do you see reparations as? I mean, it's not an easy answer. First of all, Senator, I think we all know that the dollar amount owed to African Americans for building this country, for being the original human infrastructure of this country. You know, Joe Biden talking about human infrastructure. We are, our flesh and blood bones built this country. It was built on our backs. A dollar figure is probably a number somewhere into infinity. I wouldn't put that pressure on anyone to come up with that singular number. But when we talk about reparations, I mean, we can talk about some type of compensation for individuals, but also investment in our community, the likes of which existed for the white middle class. You know history well, Senator Brown. You know, white middle class didn't just pop up out of by magic from under Cabbage Patch. There was investment. I mean, there was one time in this country, everybody was poor. Everybody was doing bad. There was no Social Security. When you got to be our age, Senator, our loved ones just put us out to pasture and we died. But during the Roosevelt administration, and even before that, there was investment. There was homesteading. There was the GI Bill, and there was Social Security, which originally excluded African Americans, and so reparations could be just that. Those incentives, those encouragement, those loans for home ownership, after all, America's wealth, the wealth that people have in America, to the extent that they have wealth, but they're not in the 1%, is in their homes. So it could mean that. It could mean free college tuition so that we get caught up as African Americans when it comes to the so-called American dream. So, you know, people should understand this commission would look at all of that, and it would hold public hearings. It would be empowered to do that. So some people, so just to be clear, folks, we've got H.R. 40 is almost in the place where Justice and Policing and For the People Act were. It is on the cusp of passing the House. But what good is that? That also goes to the Senate and dies, Senator Brown. Mm-hmm. So there are a total of over 200 co-sponsors of H.R. 40 and yes votes. By that, I mean, I think there are about 197 co-sponsors and three yes votes. A dozen more, and we go to the floor and it passes. Now, it's interesting. When we talk to members of Congress and we lobby them to become co-sponsors, Senator, the first reaction is, especially from those in moderate, vulnerable districts who are Democrats, well, we don't want to agree to a dollar figure. We're not ready to start writing checks for reparations. We say, oh, that's not what we're talking about. The commission would determine what that would be, not you. And so when these members of Congress hear that, Senator, they said, oh, well, that's a little different. That makes sense. So it's not as if people are voting today on what a dollar figure would be or what reparations would be. This is establishing a commission to go through a very thoughtful process to determine what that would be. And so it's very important. Let me tell you something. We can do all the justice and policing. We can deal with voter suppression. We can do all these things. But until we deal with America's original sin, when Adam bit from that apple, until we deal with that and correct that, nothing will ever be right. Because this bill also deals with the vestiges of slavery, not just slavery itself, but all the vestiges, including lynching and poll taxes and voter suppression and mass incarceration and police violence. So really, for the people, justice and policing, those bills deal with what's in the immediate. H.R. 40 deals with those bills are dealing with, but also what has been cumulative in the past, all of these things. And the toll keeps going up. The longer America delays addressing the issue of reparation, the more the toll keeps going up. So I'm sure that's a long answer than what you wanted, but
that's exactly what I wanted. And yeah, I can
and,
tell
and
you
that will be the issue. Also, that will also be an issue on August 28th. And again, folks, the senator is here. I hope everyone understands the importance of D.C. statehood. Because if you've got D.C. statehood, a lot of these things are addressed. So it's not just random. Oh, well, we don't really think the district was meant to be a capital. Uh-uh. People say that, but that's not the real reason. They don't want Senator Michael Brown empowered to vote for your best interests on Capitol Hill. That's what this is. That's what it has always been about. They don't want Senator Michael Brown to vote to end the filibuster. And if I could, Senator, let me just say a word or two about the filibuster. It has its roots in the period of enslavement, in the period of lynchings. It was used to uphold those institutions, but it is obsolete. So obsolete, think about it. A minority of senators, most of whom happen to be white men, so a minority of white men are able to control and dominate democracy, in fact, deny democracy to a majority of people. A minority of white men denying democracy to a majority of people. There's a word for that. And we all were involved in this struggle, too, and it was called apartheid. That's what it is. Fox News attacked me. Oh, Mark Thompson said apartheid. Well, I mean, apartheid is apartheid is apartheid. If a minority is holding power over a majority, that's what it is. And in a discriminatory fashion, they didn't like it. But we're going to call a spade a spade. This is why we need statehood. So again, H.R. 40 for the people, justice and policing, infrastructure, all the things we know that a majority of Americans want, the polls show us, a majority of Americans are in favor of all mostly progressive ideas. So that should be reflected. And D.C. statehood would resolve that overnight because it wouldn't just be so we could call ourselves a state. I mean, that's fun. It'd be fun to say the Douglas Commonwealth, wouldn't it? But more importantly, it would give us those two votes in the Senate that are necessary to get all these other bills passed.
Well, you know, Reverend, it's always perplexed me that the Republicans fight with everything they've got to keep that from happening, but the Democrats don't do the same to make it happen. I've always wondered why we don't fight as hard on the Democratic side, you know, that we have people like Joe Manchin and Senator Sinema from Arizona, that we don't fight as hard as the Republicans fight against us. And we don't fight that hard for it. And let me just say one more thing about reparations. And one of the reasons that I'm passionate about it is because I am a walking, talking example of white privilege. I grew up in North New Jersey as a small child behind a factory in a really crappy neighborhood where there was a lot of violence and other stuff. And my parents moved me to nice white Montgomery County, Maryland. And then unfortunately, they both died. I was orphaned at the age of 15. I dropped out of high school. I worked. I got arrested. I got in all sorts of trouble. And you know what? In my nice white neighborhood, there were people there that helped me, got me back into school, got me a GED. I ended up with a master's degree. And I was convinced, I used to go back to my grandmother's house in Newark. I was convinced if the same things had happened to me in that neighborhood, I wouldn't have survived. I survived because of the area that I was in, and the fact that we weren't impoverished, that we were, you know, that people reached out to me and helped me. And so I feel an obligation to all those people that I have seen discriminated against. You know, I think God talks to me, Reverend. I think he talks to all of us. And the key is learning how to listen, you know. And I've never been poor, but I've been broke a lot of times. So I've been close enough to poverty to see it, you know. Being broke is something you can work your way out of. All you need is a little money. Poverty is a whole different thing. It's a cycle. So I think you're exactly
I appreciate you for sharing your story, and more people need to share the story, yes. Because in this country, a lot of people have been through what you've been through, Senator.
That's right.
And it takes courage to share that. I went to West Virginia Red Bomber. I never seen broke and poor white folks like that. It was an eye opener to me, and how relieved and happy they were that we showed up. I mean, talk about they would come up and just start telling stories about what they're dealing with, and watch this, and then the hardship they have, and then say, and then Reverend Mark, we watched Joe Manchin whip through town in his Porsche.
Yeah,
and it's disgusting us. I mean, I'm sitting there listening. It really broke my heart. You know, as an African American, you know, I'm very familiar with what our struggles have been. But then when I saw white folk doing that bad, and they were just glad to be seen and heard. Just because, oh, we're so glad you're here. We're so glad that somebody cares about us. This is what this country is dealing with. And frankly, what did I say? The establishment of white middle class, well, that needs a reset. The establishment, we can't continue to live off the white middle class formula of 80 years ago either. So the point is, all of this must be addressed, one. Two, the last thing I'll say about reparations is this. If we know we need a white middle class reset, and we know we need black reparations, imagine what that would do in terms of lifting all boats, Senator. How much better all of us would be doing as working class people, true working class. Because right now, let's be honest, folks, working class really means working poor. There's not working class prosperity in this country right now. And so all of this would address that. And to Sinema and Manchin, and Democrats who were scared. Oh, we don't want to get rid of the filibuster, Rem Mark and Senator Brown, because what if we lose the majority? We'll need it. I'm sorry. Let's do some math here. You have the majority in the House and the Senate, especially what just happened in Georgia, because of black votes. Let's be clear. A coalition of black votes and everybody else. But black votes in particular who turned out overwhelmingly and disproportionately. Okay. If you don't get rid of the filibuster, or at the minimum do a carve-out to get for the People Act through, this suppression is going to get you out of the majority. So the fear of losing the majority is guaranteed unless you get rid of the filibuster and do a carve-out to stop voter suppression. So that, you know, I know people think because they have Senate in front of their name, people assume that people should genuflect and think they're intelligent. But, Michael, that's not intelligent. Yeah. And that's what they say. Oh, we're going to lose. If we do the filibuster, what if we lose? If you don't get rid of the filibuster, you are going to lose. That's just basic, simple, 1 + 1 = 2. It's not emotion. This ain't radical. This is not. This is just pure, absolute logic. And you know, if you are Democrats and you want to stay in power, you have got to move that filibuster off the table. So we can keep you in power, so you can continue to have people to vote for you. And if you don't do it, then maybe we need to rethink what this party is doing and what you all are really representing. You know, Rem Barber told me something, and I'll shut up. He said that the For the People Act and some of its provisions, I was going to say to Senator Brown, you probably know this, would even put some Democrats who are in office now in jeopardy. I'm talking about Democrats. You know, we got some folk up there that have been in office, been holding the Senate seat for 40, 50 years. Okay? And the For the People Act would put some of them in a position to be challenged by a younger generation. And that some feel that that's one of the reasons why they're holding this up and don't want to get rid of the filibuster. For example, and I don't have a whole lot against Chuck Schumer. Chuck's done some good things, Senator Schumer. But if before the People Act were to go through, the speculation could very well be that it would open doors for AOC to challenge him for a Senate seat. And so there's a disincentive to getting it through. So we've got to deal with all of that.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And you know what? This is my humble opinion, Reverend. And I would say this in regard to what you said to both our friend from West Virginia and the senator from Arizona. I think God hates a coward. I think that, you know, when you're up there, you have to be brave. And I agree with you again 100%. Let me ask you one more thing.
Let me say this to you, and I'm going to say it all. Listen, anybody who don't think, who think that only black people are poor and doing bad, go to West Virginia.
Yeah.
And get sober. Just take a little trip before you go. Just go there and just observe. And then see how that man's riding all around town in a Porsche. And he says he's doing this because his constituency, the constituency don't know what he's talking about. He has a Porsche. They don't.
I know. Well, let me say, and neither do I, but let me ask you one more about one more issue, and that's the end of gun violence. You know, we've just had so many horrible things happen lately, like a 6-year-old girl here in D.C. who was shot through the head by a stray bullet and killed, or that poor woman on the L.A. freeway whose baby was killed because she cut some guy off in traffic. And we know that more guns means more gun violence. And we need to teach these people that the Second Amendment is not the Second Commandment. You don't have a God-given right for a gun and any kind of gun. But how do we address that? There's so much pushback. Do we need to organize better? What do we need to do to get assault weapons? What use is an assault weapon to an individual in our society except to do horrendous acts?
Well, so let me also mention the issue of ending gun violence is a big part of August 28th at the Lincoln Memorial. We're going to be dealing with that. In fact, on August 26th, there's going to be a gun violence summit in Southeast Washington at the Southeast Tennis and Learning Center. That's going to be happening as well. And so this, all of this is very, very important and critical to what we are dealing with. I want to say something, and this may be a little bit controversial too. I've already accused the filibuster of being apartheid. I hope I don't get you. What radio station are we on right now? I don't want to get you into.
We're on PBS Radio, and that's what this whole show is about. It's about making people think. And you know, one thing that I would add, since you brought up South Africa. South Africa used to be in the same position as D.C., but they changed that 20 years ago. And when your human rights record lags 20 years behind South Africa, I think that really says something. But go ahead. Make your controversial.
No, that says like, well let me make another controversial statement. I would invite people to read. I'll give people a homework assignment. Google Professor Carl T. Bogus. He is a leading scholar on the hidden history of the Second Amendment. It was not about an individual right to bear arms, to romanticize being taken over by the federal government. The reason for the Second Amendment, back to reparations, back to enslavement, was that Patrick Henry and others feared slave insurrection. And they were becoming more prominent. We don't hear that much about that in history because we were never educated about our own self-liberation. But there were a number of slave insurrections in the 1700s, the 1800s. So what they said, listen, we need to keep these guns. You can't conscript us and all of our firearms to go fight the British or foreign countries, because we need to keep some guns because all these slaves are revolting. It is documented. And all the deliberations around the Bill of Rights, go and look it up for yourselves, folks. So again, just like the filibuster, an obsolete measure on the books, the Second Amendment is not applicable to today. And I think we all know the framers, including Patrick Henry, did not intend for that amendment to be used for people to use guns, including assault weapons, to go out here and kill each other. Let's face it, we're humans. We're flawed. And in a COVID economy, all right, you got guns everywhere. People have no jobs, no money, or fewer jobs and less money. People turn on themselves. They do it in the home. Most of these gun incidents happen in homes. We see these things in the street. But people don't look at the number of suicides that are taking place, including by members of our own military. People don't look at the number of gun accidents that happen every day in this country. Americans are not doing well with guns at all, Senator Brown. Whether we out here in the streets of Southeast Washington gangbanging, it doesn't even have to be. If that stopped today, when you look at the gun death statistics in terms of home violence, in terms of accidents, in terms of suicides, it's even greater. We don't do well with guns, y'all. And we've got to cut that out. And again, this home invasion fantasy. When's the last time you turn on the news and saw a story about a home invasion? Local news always leaves with a bleed, with whatever violence is taking place. When's the time you turn on the news and saw a home invasion? That's the fantasy people have. Oh, I need a gun because that may be a home invasion. When's the last time you even heard about folks running up in folks' home invading them? So all of that, and then those home invasion guns end up being either being turned on other family members or end up causing a suicide or end up being in an accident. So we got to get over this. During COVID, during George Floyd, I was doing a lot of interviews, as I'm sure you were too, Senator Brown. Other countries around the world were very interested in our plight in America and curious about guns. And these are countries that don't have those problems. And I was into this. I said, you know what? We need to figure out what you all do, because, like, even in Britain, folks ain't over there shooting everybody, each other every day in Britain. So many other countries say, well, that's just not happening. People are not just gunning each other down. There is something in this country, something wrong with our relationship with guns. If there is a denial about the desperation that is taking place. Again, we need a middle class reset. We need a working class reset. We need reparations. There is a denial about all of the things that lead people to the point of being exasperated, I'm sorry, whereas a gun becomes the solution. And let's be honest, Senator Brown, we're men. I'll tell you another Washingtonian, the great Dr. Frances Cress Wells, and she talked about guns at the very least subconsciously serving as some type of ego piece for a man, something that men need for their self-esteem. Well, you know, just think about it. When you're doing bad and the working class is doing bad and you have no money and you're broke and we're going in the COVID economy, think about it. That gun even becomes an even bigger crutch. This is my manhood. In fact, if you look at some of the gun advertisers, the gun industry advertisers, they have advertisements like that. Get your manhood back. This is your manhood, an assault weapon. All right? So it becomes that for us. And it can't be. We cannot continue to sustain as a society, to sustain ourselves and live and thrive and survive this way with guns at the helm the way they are.
I got to tell you, again, Reverend, I think you hit it the nail on the head. When I was a little boy, my father had a Colt revolver, which was a collector's piece, actually. It was a ball and cap kind of six gun, one of the first six guns. Really, really, you wouldn't have been able to use it unless, you know, you had powder and balls and all that stuff. But they used to hide it from me, and I found it every time. I remember being a little boy standing in front of the mirror with that in my belt, thinking that I was Jesse James and I was so cool. And that's why I never had a gun in my house, because I had a son. And I knew that men have men and boys have a natural attraction to those things. And that's a big problem. And I think that when you talk, I know another thing that you want to talk about at the march is reimagining public safety and ending mass incarceration stuff. I think we need to build a system, finally, that's built on our values and not on our fears. I think that all this, the system that we have now, was built on fears, many of them, as you've already pointed out, which are imagined and are not real. So I agree again with you. But one last thing, if you could talk about this quickly, because my co-host is not here today. She had something come up in her life that she had to deal with, but she's from California. And I know the first thing that she would have asked you, as California is burning to the damn ground, what do we do about climate change? How do we embrace what Dr. King called the urgency of now and realize that we need a new green economy and we need to address climate? We can't address climate change too aggressively or too immediately, in my opinion. What do you think?
No, I agree. That is an urgency, and we better address it soon, because guess what? Truthfully, just as reparations would address a lot of these other issues, climate change addresses even more of them. And by that I mean, what's the point of ending voter suppression? What's the point of reimagining policing? What's the point of having reparations if we're all burning up in the environment? You know, there's a saying in the black community, crabs in a barrel. How, you know, sometimes when one of us is trying to make it to the top, the others manage to pull them down. That's the weight of oppression.
Yeah.
When Hillary Clinton ran for president, I had white women call my show, Senator, and say, Rev. Mark, white women suffer from crabs in a barrel, too, because there were women who just could not, you know, get with the thought of voting for a woman. It's sort of a self piece that we've got to do. Well, but there's also crabs in a barrel for climate change. But it's the more, even more literal. It's really not even crabs in a barrel. It's more so crabs in a pot. You know, when you're cooking crabs, when you're boiling crabs, they put them in the water. And the crab's like, oh, cool, I'm in some water. After a little while, the crab starts saying, wait a minute, this water's getting a little hot. And it's getting hotter, and it's burning me up. That, as we have sat here talking, we've been burning up, Senator. We are literally all black, white, women, men, crabs in a pot, because we are cooking ourselves. These vehicles we're still riding in, Joe Biden says by 2030, half the cars in America need to be electric. Man, all of them. I mean, that's what we've got. We have got to do it. And if someone put their mind to it, it could happen. If the industry was smart, I was actually kind of glad, because the industry was with him last week. And they admitted that check this out. This is their incentive. They're behind the rest of the world, Senator. Everybody else in the world has electric cars. What is wrong with us? What's up? No, I know what it is. We want guns. We too fixated on guns. Yeah. Everybody going to have a gun while we burn up in the environment. Isn't that fun? Doesn't that sound like fun? No, we got to get this thing together, man. We really, really do. It's urgent for our survival. It's urgent for humankind. And I look at all these cities, even, including the district. It was the automobile industry. It wasn't politicians. I'm in Atlanta right now, similar to D.C. in terms of its public transit system, okay? It wasn't politicians who decided to limit public transportation to make it greener. It was the automobile industry. They lobbied. They spend billions of dollars. We don't want subways. I live in New York. I'm in Atlanta right now. The automobile industry, Senator, said, we don't want subway systems like New York in D.C. and Atlanta and Los Angeles. They fought that. That wasn't just some decision. Well, we just rather not have that. Imagine if we had a subway system in D.C. like New York, how green D.C. would be. You understand? And don't get me wrong. New York has its problems. It's crazy in New York. But there's a subway stop on every corner, and which is an incentive not to burn up fossil fuels in the car. That's why, in spite of New York's other problems, it's considered one of the greenest cities in the world, just because of its 100-year-old subway. Now, 100 years ago, they weren't thinking climate change. It just worked out that way. But we need that in these other spaces. We need electric vehicles. That has to be a priority, too. And that's precisely why some people said, you're doing too much on August 28th. But we have a lot to do. There's much to do, and we're going to do it. And so I'm sorry I have to leave you. I've really enjoyed our talk. I'd love to come back again. Folks, we can't miss this opportunity. We invite you to go to MakeGoodTroubleRally.com to find out more about the Gun Violence Summit in Southeast Washington, D.C., to find out more about on August 26th, to find out more about August 28th. All of these things, all of this is very, very important as we move forward. We can't just tweet about it. You know, we cannot change things with just a tweet. We've got to get out here and make some good trouble in the streets. So we invite everyone to join us in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial. God bless you, Senator, and thank you for
having me. Yeah, and God bless you, Reverend. Thanks so much for being with us. You have an open invitation to come back anytime. And I will be there on the 28th.
That's right. You should be the Senator. So you think about it. Nelson Mandela was in exile, the de facto president. Yep. You are the de facto senator. You are our Nelson Mandela of Washington, D.C., yep, because you're in exile and do not have a vote in D.C.
Oh, my God. Reverend, if you say that again, my head's going to get so big it will explode. All right. Thank you so much for being on the show. We'll talk again soon.
Love you, man. Take care.
Love you, too. Bye. Well, that was the Reverend Mark Thompson, who, you know, was committed to statehood. I mean, Long Beach, I've been in the movement I've been elected for 15 years and in it a little before then. And Reverend Thompson was in it long before I was. So, you know, we hold him in high esteem here in Washington for the work that he's done, and for his, you know, his opinion that the people of the District of Columbia should be equal citizens. I'm going to get on my soapbox a little bit because I have 10 minutes, which I generally don't have on the show, you know, because we have a guest that generally stay to the very end of the show, and I've got a co-host, Maria, and so I get a few minutes in at the end of the show, but today I have a little longer, and I'm going to make a plea to anybody that's out there to get on our website, Douglas Commonwealth, and look that up, Douglas Commonwealth, Inc., and you can get details about what we're going to do on the 28th. We'd like to see as many people out there as we can get, because statehood is really important to the District of Columbia. I believe, and I think the Founding Fathers did, that equality is a prerequisite of our democracy. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal." On the Lincoln Memorial, as we stand behind the Lincoln, in front of the Lincoln Memorial, behind us, carved in granite, are the words, "Our forefathers set forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal." So it's time to make that true. It's time to say enough is enough. And, to stand up and say it's time to enfranchise 700,000 people who have paid taxes and fought in wars ever since we've been part of America since America began. In fact, my great 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 grandfather was a man named Joel Prescott, Dr. Joel Prescott, who enlisted in the Continental Army when he was 17 years old. And he was a combat veteran who put his life, liberty, and property on the line to secure for himself and his posterity the blessings of liberty. And that's why I started this journey more than 15 years ago, because I said, what would he think of me what would he think of me accepting my second-class citizenship when he had done so much to leave to me a legacy of liberty? He wouldn't, I would think that he would be disappointed in me. So I felt the need to stand up, and the more I stood up, the more I realized how important this is. As Reverend Thompson pointed out, two more liberal Democratic senators from the District of Columbia would make all the difference in the world. Now, I'm not egotistical enough to believe that I would be one of the first voting senators, but I can assure you that the two senators that were elected from the district would, in fact, be liberal Democrats. We have no elected Republicans in the District of Columbia, and this is one of our problems. This is why the Republicans stand firmly against us. They don't believe that people's, or they don't profess to believe that we should be unequal, but they put roadblocks up all the time. They say, you have to amend the Constitution, which we know has only been amended 17 times since it was written, since the first 10 amendments in the last 200 years, 17 times, because the first 10 amendments, which we call the Bill of Rights, was actually an addendum to the Constitution. They were like things we forgot to do in the Constitution. And since then, we've only amended it 17 times, but 33 states have entered the Union. So obviously, it's easier to become a state than it is to amend the Constitution. And why do we want to be a state? Because all states enter the Union on equal footing. If we are a state, we're immediately equal with everybody else. There are all sorts of crazy arguments like we're not big enough to be a state. Well, we are bigger than Wyoming and Vermont. We're already bigger than two states in population. And representation in both houses of Congress is not based on land area. It's based on population in the House and statehood in the Senate. That's why California and Rhode Island both have two senators. It has nothing to do with the size of your state and the size of the jurisdiction. We meet all the qualifications for statehood. And lately, the Republicans have gotten particularly crazy. We had a member of Congress say that we didn't have a car dealership or we didn't have an airport, and that disqualified. That's crazy. Almost every state entered into the Union without a car dealership or an airport because the car and the airplane hadn't been invented yet. Something like, I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it's like 38 states came in without a car dealership or an airport. So these things are crazy, and it's really all about partisanship. It's just about whether we're going to elect two more Democrats and send them to the Senate, which we would surely do, at least for the time being. You know, this has always been an argument in statehood. Partisanship has always been the major factor. If you look at Hawaii and Alaska, they said the same thing. They said Alaska would never elect a Republican, and Hawaii would never elect a Democrat. Well, I think every elected official in both houses from Hawaii is a Democrat. And in Alaska, they only have one person, a statewide elected official, who's not a Republican. So those things change over time. And unfortunately for the Republican Party, that's the way democracy works. You don't get to choose who you want up there. The people get to choose. And the only way they can keep us from choosing people they don't like on the Republican side is to keep us from choosing at all. And that's just incredible to me. And we need to change that. And if you come out on the 28th of August to the mall, or you show your support virtually by going on our website, or you somehow support us in some other way, you'll be making a better democracy by fulfilling the promise of equality for all Americans. You know, when I was a kid, I used to stand up next to my desk dutifully every day and put my hand over my heart and say, "With liberty and justice for all." I believed it then, I believe it now, and I will do my best to make it happen. And I hope that you'll join with me as we move forward. We passed legislation in the House of Representatives. We need to pass it in the Senate. As Mark said, we need to suspend the filibuster. And if you can't suspend the rule for something as basic as the right to representation in a democracy, then there's nothing that you can suspend the rule for. And a rule with no exception becomes a tool of tyranny. It's no longer a tool of our democracy. It becomes a tool to hold people down and repress them and stand in the way of all our democratic values. Well, thank you for joining us tonight. My best goes out to my co-host, Maria Sanchez, who has a special occasion. I hope she's having a wonderful time. And we hope you'll be back next week. We hope to have another interesting guest, and I'm sure we will. And thank you so much for joining us. We know that there's lots of things you can do with your time, and we appreciate it when you spend it with us. We end the show every week with a song, usually dedicated to the person that we've had on. And this goes out to the Reverend Mark Thompson. Here's Pharrell Williams with Freedom. Thank you.